It makes no sense. Why go to all that trouble and then blow the gaff with no provocation whatsoever? Now he was talking to me as if I were a grown-up, and I have to say I loved it. There can be only one reason, I told him, returning the favor. She needs to make an ally of me. Adam's eyes went hooded for a moment, and then he said,
I think you may be right. Are you prepared to play along?
Up until that moment, my usual response would have been to nod, but I did not. Yes, I told him.
Good, he said, and so shall I.
He stuck out a hand and I shook it to avoid making a scene.
Now that we're partners, so to speak, there's something you ought to know, but before letting you in on it, I must have your most solemn pledge that you won't breathe a word.
I so pledge, I said. I had heard the expression somewhere and thought that it suited the occasion admirably. We were not partners, but I wasn't about to tell him that.
I also want you to promise me that you will not go prowling about the church, at least not alone. If you feel that you need to go there for any reason, let me know and I shall come with you.
But why? I was hardly going to saddle myself with someone old enough to be my father.
Have you ever heard of the heart of Lucifer?
Of course I have, I said. We were taught it in Sunday school. It's a legend.
How much of it do you remember?
Following the crucifixion of our Lord, I began, parroting almost word for word Miss Lavinia Puddock's account to our childish ears. It is said that Joseph of Arimathea brought to Britain the Holy Grail, the vessel which had contained the blood of Christ. When Joseph laid down his staff at Glastonbury Abbey, it took root, and there sprang forth a bush whose like had never before been seen. This was the famous Glastonbury thorn, and from its branches was carved a crozier, or shepherd's staff, of our own dear Saint Tancred, into which was set a precious stone called the Heart of Lucifer, which was said to have fallen from the sky and thought by some to be the Holy Grail itself. It all seems rather a muddle, I added.
Well done, Adam said. You can see the crook of his crozier beside his face in the carving.
The one that's leaking blood, I said enthusiastically.
Have you confirmed that in your laboratory? Adam asked.
I was about to, but I was interrupted. I saw you taste the stuff in the church. What did you think?
I shall wait upon your chemical analysis. Then we shall see if your test tubes agree with my taste buds.
What were you going to tell me? I asked. The thing that you said I ought to know. Adam's face was suddenly serious.
In the latter years of the war, a person named Jeremy Pole, whom I had known slightly at university, was doing research at the Public Record Office when he made rather a startling discovery. While sifting through bales of quite boring charters from the Middle Ages, he came upon a small book which had once been in the library, or scriptorium, of Glastonbury Abbey, which had been sacked, there's no other way of putting it, by Henry VIII in 1539, in spite of the fact that the Benedictine monks were said to be at ease among royalty. I suppose that proves, if nothing else, that royalty was not at ease among the Benedictines. Westminster Abbey, as you will remember, began life as a Benedictine monastery. Their libraries were known to have been a treasure trove of rare and unique documents. That of Glastonbury, specifically, contained a number of early and original histories of England.
As a matter of fact, I didn't remember. It was a bit of history that I had never known, but I loved it that Adam pretended I did. He was definitely improving.
Here was the odd thing about Pole's discovery. Although this ancient little leather-bound book was sandwiched between many packets of mouldy cowhide court rolls, there were no corresponding marks either above it or below.
It had been put there recently, I said.
Excellent. That also was Pole's conclusion.
Someone had hidden it there.
Full marks, Flavia, Adam said. Well done.
I resisted brushing off my shoulders.
When he leafed through it, he found that it was a household book written in Latin and kept by the cellarer at Glastonbury, a certain Ralph. Expenses and so on and so on. Nothing very exciting. A few notes here and there on what was happening at the Abbey. Great storms, deaths and droughts. Not a chronicle as such, but more a notebook kept by a busy man who was more concerned with the still room, the bees, and the state of the herb garden, which is why Pole brought it to my attention. As with many monastic documents, it was filled with scribbling round the edges. Marginalia, we call it nowadays. Little notes jotted in the margins about this and that. Such things as, don't forget the eggs, metheglin for Father Abbott's stomach. Metheglin was a kind of spiced mead, a fermented honey offshoot of beekeeping. All the craze in the monasteries, the Guinness stout of its day. At any rate, Pole was leafing idly through these notes. They weren't really his field, you know, when the word Adamus caught his eye. Latin for diamond, a most uncommon word to find among monkish writings. The text noted, in surprisingly few matter-of-fact words, the death of the bishop, Tancred de Lucy.
For a few moments, my mind did not register what my ears had heard. De Lucy, I said at last, slowly. Could it be?
It's altogether quite possible, Adam said. The De Luce name is, as you know, an ancient one of Norman-French origin. It has appeared in many different forms. There was, of course, famously, Sir Thomas Lucy of Charlecote Park in Warwickshire, who was said, probably wrongly, to have had a young man named William Shakespeare brought up before him on a charge of poaching the Charlecote deer.
Damn, I said.
Quite, Adam agreed.
He picked up a pebble and shied it to one side of the dabbling ducks. There was a sudden excited quacking, a flutter of wings, and then they settled once more into their eternal dipping and diving.
But there's more, he added. Would you like to hear it?
I gave him such a look.
A few pages later, Ralph the Cellarer records that the bishop has been laid to rest. You'll be interested in this. At Lacey.
Not Bishop's Lacey?
No. It wasn't given that name until after his death. He was laid to rest, according to Ralph, who must have attended the funeral, with great and solemn pomp in his mitre, cope, and crozier.
The crozier having the heart of Lucifer set into it?
The very same,
Adam said in a low voice, as if there was some danger of us being overheard.
In the margin, Ralph made the note, oculi mei conspexi, and the single word, Adamus, which means, more or less, I have seen this diamond with my own eyes. It's interesting that he chose to write the marginalia in Latin.
Why? I demanded.
Because it would have been as easily understood by everyone at the Abbey as the English in which his notebook was kept.
Perhaps someone else made the note.
No, it was in the same handwriting. What it means is that we have an eyewitness report, or as near as, damn it, to the fact that St. Tancred was interred with his mitre, cope and crozier, the heart of Lucifer and all.
But why has nobody ever found this out?
History is like the kitchen sink, Adam answered. Everything goes round and round, until eventually, sooner or later, most of it goes down the wastepipe. Things are forgotten, things are mislaid, things are covered up. Sometimes it's simply a matter of neglect. During the last century and a half, there have been amateur sportsmen who made a hobby of digging through the rubble of our island's history, mostly for their own enlightenment and amusement. But with two recent wars, that's come almost to a halt. Nowadays, the past is a luxury which nobody can afford. No one has the time for it.
Do you? I asked.
I try to, he said. although I am not always successful.
Is that all, then? I asked.
All?
All that you wanted to tell me. All that I've given you my pledge not to repeat. A shadow came over his face.
I'm afraid, he said, that it is only the beginning.
He picked up another pebble, as if he were going to toss it carefree among the ducks, but thought better of it and let the stone drop from his fingers.
The thing of it is, he said, that someone else within the past, say, 10 years, has happened upon the scribblings of Ralph the Cellarer and found them important enough to hide in a pile of old vellum. As is so often the case, I fear that there's a diamond at the bottom of it all.
St. Tancred's Crozier! I let out a whistle.
Precisely.
It's in his tomb, I said, hopping from one foot to the other.
I believe it is, Adam said. Do you know anything about diamonds in history?
Not much, I told him, other than that they were once thought to be both poison and antidote to poison.
Quite true. Diamonds were also thought to confer invisibility, to defend against the evil eye, and, at least according to Pliny the Elder, to give men the power to see the faces of the gods. Anansitiri in hydromantia dicunt evocari imaginis deorum. They were believed at the beginning of the 16th century by a Venetian named Camillus Leonardus to be a help to lunatics and such as are possessed with the devil. He also believed they could tame wild beasts and prevent nightmares. The diamond in the breastplate of the Jewish high priest was once believed to become clear in the presence of an innocent man and turn cloudy in the presence of a guilty one. And Rabbi Yehuda in the Talmud was said during a voyage to have placed a diamond on some salted birds, which came back to life and flew away with the stone.
Do you believe those things?
No, Adam said. But I like to keep in mind that when a thing is believed to have a certain effect, that it often does. It is also wise to remember that when it comes to diamonds, there is one power which they possess, without a doubt, and that is the power to make people kill.
Are you talking about Mr. Qualicat? I asked.
To be blunt, yes, which is why I want you to keep well away from the church. Let me deal with it. That's why I'm in Bishop's Lacey. It's my job.
Is it? I asked. I should have thought it Inspector Hewitt's.
There are more things in heaven and earth than Inspector Hewitt, Adam said.
May I ask you one question? I said, screwing up my courage.
You may try.
Who are you working for?
The air between us went suddenly cool, as if a phantom breeze had blown upon us from the past. I'm afraid I can't tell you that, he said.
Chapter 17. Back home at Buckshaw, I hunched over my notebook in the laboratory. I had found by experience that putting things down on paper helped to clear the mind in precisely the same way, as Mrs. Mullet had taught me, that an eggshell clarifies the consommé or the coffee, which, of course, is a simple matter of chemistry. The albumen contained in the eggshell has the property of collecting and binding the rubbish that floats in the dark liquid, which can then be removed and discarded in a single reeking clot. A perfect description of the writing process. I glanced up at Esmeralda, who was perched on a cast-iron laboratory stand, cocking her head to keep an eye on the 2 eggs she had laid in my bed. 2 eggs which I was now steaming in a covered glass flask. If she was saddened by the sight of her offspring being boiled alive, Esmeralda did not show it.
Stiff upper lip, or beak, I told her.
But she was more interested in the bubbling water than in my false sympathy. Chickens are much less emotional than humans.
Steamed Eggs Deluxe Deluce, I called my invention. Mrs. Mullet's ghastly hard-boiled eggs, with their green circle around the yolk, looking for all the world like the planet Saturn with its rings poisoned, the very thought of the things gives me the hoolibobs, had forced me to find a chemical solution to the problem. An eggshell, I reasoned, is composed chiefly of calcium carbonate, CaCO3, which, although it does not itself boil until it reaches a very high temperature, begins to decompose nevertheless at 100 degrees Celsius, the boiling point of water. Steamed, covered, for 10 minutes, the crystalline structure of the calcium carbonate is weakened. After another 10 minutes or so in cold water, the egg can then be given a light tap on a hard surface and rolled lightly under the hand along its equator until the shell shatters into crystals and can be peeled away almost in a single piece, as easily as skinning a tangerine. The white is firm without being rubbery, and the yolk a perfect daffodil yellow. Farewell, hard-boiled eggs. Hail, steamed eggs deluxe deluce. It was a perfect solution for anyone who hates struggling with the shells of boiled eggs, or who bites their fingernails. I would write a cookbook and become famous. Flavia Cooks, I would call it, and I would become known as the Egg Lady. Better living through chemistry, as the people at DuPont are forever telling us in their adverts in the picture post. I picked up my pencil. The Heart of Lucifer, I wrote, then crossed it out. On second thought, I tore out the page and held it to the flame of a Bunsen burner, then washed the black ashes down the sink. Much as I was aching to set down in writing the story of that priceless stone, I realized that I didn't dare. It was not safe, nor was it wise, to commit certain things to paper. Diaries and notebooks could always be read by prying eyes. It had been known to happen. For now, I would confine myself to people. Adam Tradescant Sowerby, I wrote on a new page and underlined it. This was going to be difficult. I had such tangled feelings toward the man. Admits he's a private investigator, but who is employing him? And how much does he know? It was odd, wasn't it, that he had asked me no questions about my own findings. He seemed not in the least curious about anything I might have discovered. I drew a line, leaving more space for Adam Sowerby. I would come back to him later. Miss Tanti fancies herself an amateur detective. Fortunately, she believes that Adam and I are also. As chairman of Altar Guild, has unquestioned access to the church at all hours. Admitted to being furious with Mr. Corlicott about not picking her up for her appointment, but hardly reason enough to kill him. Other motives? Musical ones, perhaps? She had cried out at the sight of dripping blood in the church. Forgive me, O Lord, then tried to convince me that it was staged. What did she need to be forgiven for? N.B. Pry it out of Feely. Which reminded me, I had still not analyzed the red residue on my hair ribbon. I reached into my pocket. It was empty. I leapt up from the bench and dug desperately in both pockets. The ribbon was gone. Surely it had been there this morning while I was talking to Mrs. Mullet. Or had it? I had certainly thought about beginning my chemical analysis. But had I actually touched the ribbon with my hand? Probably not. Had I lost it on the riverbank while talking to Adam? Or somewhere in Miss Tanti's house? Bugger, I said. I might have dropped it anywhere. In the crypt, in the churchyard, in the tunnel, on the road to Nether Wolsey, or in the butcher's shop of that peculiar village. Or could it have fallen out of my pocket at Bogmore Hall? Was it still lying somewhere in those dusty corridors, or even in the prison cell of Jocelyn Ridley Smith's room, waiting to betray the fact that I had been there? Perhaps it had already been found by his father, the magistrate, or by the servant. What was the man's name? Benson? No matter,
I needed to get on with my notes before I forgot the details. Mad Meg. Quite harmless. At least I believe she is. Although she was the first to spot the falling blood, she didn't seem at all surprised. In fact, she immediately began quoting the Book of Revelation, as if she had come there especially to announce the miracle. Marmaduke Parr. Without even knowing the man, I can tell that he is one of those persons Father would call an ecclesiastical chameleon. Altogether a nasty piece of furniture. Why is he so determined to stop the exhumation of Saint Tancred? Or is it really the bishop who wishes to do so? Or the chancellor? Which brings us to Magistrate Ridley Smith. I've never clapped eyes on the man, but I already dislike him intensely. If only for the fact that he keeps his poor son, Jocelyn, captive like a princess in a tower. My hand stopped writing. Wasn't it passing strange, as Daffy would say, that although Harriet had visited Jocelyn Ridley Smith at Bogmore Hall, frequently, it would appear, that she had never demanded he be set free? Why not? That, perhaps, was the greatest question of all. My pencil broke with a snap. I realized suddenly that between words I had been gnawing on it and chewed the thing almost in half. I would have to continue later. Esmeralda gave a cluck, and I saw that the eggs had boiled nearly dry. I had probably ruined them. I turned off the Bunsen burner and extracted the steaming eggs from the flask with a pair of nickel-plated laboratory tongs. Using a glass funnel stuck into a flask as an egg cup, I gave the first egg a sharp crack with a graduated measuring spoon I had pinched from the kitchen and lifted off the top. The smell of hydrogen sulfide filled the air. Rotten egg gas. "An overcooked egg smells like a you-know-what," Mrs. Mallet had told me, and she was right, even though she didn't know the chemical details. Besides fats, an egg contains magnesium, potassium, calcium, iron, phosphorus, and zinc, along with a witch's brew of the amino acids, vitamins, which were not believed in by the Royal Navy until quite recently, and a long list of proteins and enzymes, including lysozyme, which is found in milk as well as in human secretions, such as tears, spit, and snot. It made no difference. I was hungry. I was spooning out the first mouthful when the door flew open and Daffy stormed into the room. I must have forgotten to lock it.
"Look at you," she shouted, her pointing finger trembling.
"What?" I said. As far as I knew, I hadn't committed any recent wickedness.
"Look at you," she said again. "Just look at you."
"Would you like an egg?" I asked, gesturing to an empty stool. "They're a little overdone."
"No." "Thank you," she added.
Good manners were as persistent in Daffy as a speck of dust stuck in the eye. "Well, sit down anyway," I said. "You're making me nervous."
"What I have to say to you needs to be said standing up."
I shrugged. "Shoot yourself," I said, but she gave me not so much as the ghost of a smile.
"Have you no sense?" she shouted. "Have you no sense at all?"
I waited for the explanation, which I suspected would not be long in coming.
"Can you not see what you're doing to Father? He's crushed, he's ill, he doesn't sleep, and you're off stirring up trouble. How can you live with yourself?"
I shrugged. I could have told her, I suppose, that just last evening I'd had a perfectly civilized chat with him. And then I remembered that I had found Father sitting alone in the kitchen in the dark. Better to wait out Daffy's anger. Even a flying bomb runs out of fuel eventually. But for the moment, Daffy was so infuriated that even though she had glanced at her several times, she had not really registered Esmeralda. I listened for what must have been 10 minutes as Daffy raged, pacing up and down the room, waving her arms, citing chapter and verse of my offences since the day that I was born, dredging up incidents that even I had forgotten.
It was an impressive spectacle. And then suddenly, she was in tears, sobbing like a little girl lost. And I found myself at her side, my arm around her, and my own vision inexplicably blurred. Neither of us spoke a word, and we didn't need to. We stood there, clinging to each other like squids, damp, quivering, and unhappy. What was going to become of us? It was a question I had been hiding from myself for longer than I cared to remember. Where would we go when Buckshaw was sold? What were we going to do? These were questions which had no answers. There were no happy outcomes. If we were lucky, the sale of Buckshaw would bring in enough to pay off Father's debts, but we would be left homeless and penniless. Father, I knew, would never accept charity. It was not in his blood. There was that word again, blood. It was everywhere, wasn't it? Dripping from the severed head of John the Baptist, falling from the face of a wooden Saint Tancred, staining my hair ribbon, oozing in all its red wonder on glass plates under my microscope. Everywhere, blood. It was what tied us together, Daffy and Feely and Father and me. I knew for certain, in that instant, that we were one. In spite of the stupid tales with which my sisters had tormented me, my blood was now screaming out to me that all of us were one and that nothing could ever tear us apart. It was the happiest and yet the saddest moment of my life. We stood there for the longest time, Daffy and I, hugging each other, not wanting to break away and have to look at each other. Faces, at times like these, were best left buried in shoulders. And then, incredibly, I heard myself saying, "There, there," and patting Daffy's shoulder. We might have laughed at that, but we didn't. Daffy, at last, snuffling, pulled away and made for the door. Our eyes did not meet. Things were back to normal. I felt rather odd as I walked slowly down the east staircase. What was happening to me? On the one hand, something had made me follow Daffy from the room, some need to continue the contact that we had just made. On the other, I wanted to kill her. Of my two sisters, Daffy was the one of whom I was most afraid. It was, I think, because of her silences. She was most often to be found curled up with a book, which in itself was a pretty enough picture, but curled up, nevertheless, coiled like a snake. One never knew when she was going to attack, and when she did, her words were poisonous. I stopped on the landing to reflect. I was being torn apart from the inside, pressed with a sort of dopey gratitude which was trying to expand me, and at the same time crushed in from the outside by the enormous weight of our situation. Would I explode, or would I be squashed? I continued, half in a daze, to the bottom of the stairs, and made my way, without realizing it, to the kitchen. Mrs. Mullet was up to her elbows in a sink full of pots. "What's the matter with you, dear?" she asked, drying her hands and turning toward me.
"You look as if you'd seen a ghost."
Perhaps I had. Perhaps I had seen the ghost of what our family life might have been if all of us were not who we were. It was all so damnably complicated. Mrs. Mullet did something she had not done since I was a little girl. She knelt down and put her hands on my shoulders and looked up into my face.
"Tell me about it,"
she said softly, pushing my hair back out of my eyes.
"Tell Mrs. M. all about it."
I suppose I could have, but I didn't. "I think it's just the thought of Feely getting married and moving away," I said, my lower lip trembling. "I'm going to miss her." Why is it, I wondered, even as I spoke, that we lie most easily when feelings are involved? It was a thought that I had never had before,
and it frightened me. What do you do when your own brain vomits up questions to which you don't know the answers? Questions that you don't even understand?
We're all going to miss her, dear, Mrs. Mallet said. We shall miss her lovely music in the house.
That did it. I burst into tears.
Why?
It's hard to explain. It was partly the thought that Mrs. Mallet was going to miss Ludwig von Beethoven and Johann Sebastian Bach, that she was going to miss Franz Schubert and Domenico Scarlatti and Pietro Domenico Paradisi, and 100 others that had been hanging round the halls of Buckshaw for as long as I could remember.
How empty the place was going to be. How bloody, awfully empty.
Mrs. Mallet wiped my eyes with her apron.
There, there, dear, she said,
just as I had said to Daffy.
I've got some hot scones coming out the oven directly. There's nothing like scones to dry up tears.
I smiled at the thought, but not very much.
Sit up the table, and I shall put the kettle on, she said. A nice cup of tea is good for the gizzard, as the bishop said to the chorus girl. Oh, sorry, dear. I oughtn't to have let that slip. It's one of them sayings Alf picked up at his regimental dinner that makes you smile. I can't think what come over me.
What was she going on about? There was nothing remotely amusing about what she had said. In fact, it made no sense at all. And yet it reminded me of something. The bishop. And the bishop reminded me of the Chancellor.
Do you know anything about Magistrate Ridley Smith? I found myself asking.
Just that he's a Tartar, she said. Them Ridley Smiths are an odd lot. Not right like.
I've heard about the one who was made of glass, I offered, and the one whose pet alligator ate the chambermaid.
Mrs. Mallet sniffed.
They were nothing compared with him, she said. He's a bad lot, magistrate and all. You keep clear of him.
But Harriet used to visit Bogmore Hall, I said.
Mrs. Mallet stopped halfway to the agar, the tea kettle frozen in her hand.
Wherever did you hear that, miss?
The room had gone suddenly cold, as it does when you've gone too far.
Oh, I don't know, I said lightly. Daffy or Feely must have mentioned it.
Miss Daphne and Miss Ophelia know nothing about it. It was a secret between Miss Harriet and me. Not even the Colonel knew. I used to make up the food hampers, and she delivered them.
To Jocelyn Ridley Smith? I asked.
Now, you listen to me, Miss Smartpants. Don't you mention that name again in this here house. They'll think it's all my fault, and I'll be given the sack for blubbering. Now off you go, and get them Ridley Smiths off your brain.
Do you think it's a sin that Harriet made friends with Jocelyn?
It isn't a question of what I think. It isn't my place to think. I drags myself in here every day and cooks for you lot, and then I goes home and there's an end of it.
But
there's an end of it,
Mrs. Mallet said loudly.
If I comes home and tells Alf I've lost my place, I hate to think what he'd say. Now off you go.
And off I went. Mrs. Mallet had given me an idea. Mrs. Mallet and Alf lived in a picturesque cottage near the end of Cobbler's Lane, a narrow track which ran off the high street and went nowhere in particular.
It's what they call a cul-de-sac, Alf says,
she had once told me. Ends all of a sudden, like a sock. A ginger cat sat in a window, watching me with one open eye. I knocked at the door and tried to look respectful. I didn't know much about the home life of the Mallets, except those titbits that Mrs. M inevitably let leak. I knew, for instance, that Alf loved custard pie, that their daughter, Agnes, had left home in the last year of the war to study Pitman shorthand, and that her bedroom had been kept ever since as a shrine to the powers of the typewriter. But I knew little else. The door opened, and there stood Alf.
You
was a man of middle age, middle height, middle hair, and medium build. His only unusual feature was in the way he stood, ramrod straight. Alf, I remembered, had been in the army, and, like Father and Dogger, knew a lot of things which must never be spoken of.
"Well, miss," he said,
"to what do we owe this prodigious great pleasure?"
The precise same words with which he had greeted me the last time I visited, 6 months ago. "I'm doing some research," I said, "and I'd appreciate having your advice."
"Research, eh? Best come in and tell me about it."
Before you could whistle the first two bars of Rule Britannia, we were sitting in a tiny kitchen that was as neat as a pin.
"Pardon me for not laying on the ballroom," Alf said, "but the missies don't like having her cushions made a mess of."
"It's all right, Mr. Mullet," I said. "I don't either."
"Sound girl," he said. "Wizard good sense."
I plunged right in. "I was chatting with Mrs. Mullet today about the Ridley Smiths," I said, matter-of-factly. Which was true, as far as it went. But only just barely.
"Ah," Alf said, non-committally, not looking at me. "Anything else?"
"No, just the Ridley Smiths. Magistrate Ridley Smith in particular."
"Ah,"
Alf said again. "His wife was very beautiful," I said. "I think I've seen a photograph of her."
"Funny old thing, isn't it?" Alf asked. "How every village has its secrets. Some things just not talked about. Ever notice that? I have."
"And this is one of them, isn't it?" I asked. Alf busied himself with the tea kettle in exactly the same way Mrs. Mallet had in the kitchen at Buckshaw. I suppose when people have been married for centuries, they become like joined paper cutouts of each other.
"Lovely day,"
Alf said, sitting himself down at the kitchen table. "Bit windy.
Not bad for March, though."
"I've been to Bogmore Hall," I said. "I've seen Jocelyn Ridley Smith. I've talked to him." There was only the slightest hesitation. If I hadn't been looking out for it, I'd have missed it.
"Have you, by George?"
"Yes," I said. It was a bit of a stalemate. Alf flicked a crumb off the tabletop, then bent down and picked it up from the floor, examining it as intently as if it were a bit of fallen moon dust. "I need your help, Mr. Mullet," I said. "I'm doing genealogical research for an article I'm thinking of writing. The Norman roots of certain families residing in the parish of..." I could see by his grin, even before I finished speaking, that it wasn't going to work. "The truth is, I know that you were in the army," I said, changing tactics. "I know that because of the Official Secrets Act, there are things that you are still forbidden to speak of. I am not going to ask you about them. I am not going to ask you about my father, for instance, and I am not going to ask you about Dogger. It would be putting you on the spot." Alf nodded. "But I am going to ask you about Mrs. Ridley Smith because, well, because I need to know. It's important to Jocelyn, too. I hope you'll understand. It could be a matter of life and death." "Secrets or no secrets," I added. I could tell by the way he avoided my eyes that he was wavering. "I know that you're a great expert on the British military. Everybody in Bishop's Lacey says so. A walking encyclopedia, they call you."
"Is that a fact?" Alf said.
"Yes," I told him, crossing my heart with my first two fingers crossed and extending my other hand so that he could see I wasn't cancelling out the cross with a negative sign behind my back. "It's a fact. Mrs. Mullet says so too." I could see him softening.
"You've heard of the Battle of Plassey," he said.
It was a statement, not a question. I shook my head no. Once I got him started, I didn't dare interrupt.
"How about Clive of India?"
I shook my head again.
Shocking, he said.
We shall correct that, PDQ.
What could this possibly have to do with the Ridley Smiths? I couldn't begin to guess.
Chapter 18.
India, in them days, was like heaven and hell, tossed into a storm kettle and boiled. Still and all, everyone was dying to get into it. The French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, and, yeah, the English too, all clawing away at one another to be top dog. To say nothing of the Mohammedans and the Mughals, what were trying to hang on to what was rightly theirs. More wars than you could count on all your toes and fingers put together. Fought over a country full of snakes, elephants, lions, leopards, tigers, rivers, mountains, monsoons, and malaria.
But why? I asked.
Business, Alf said. Agriculture, tea and timber, rice, coffee and cotton, opium.
Ah, I said, as if I understood. Who won?
We did, of course.
At the Battle of Plassey? I asked, trying to be one jump ahead of him.
Among others, Alf said. That was just one of them. One of the best, though. Bengal, Trichinopoly, Pondicherry, Coromandel. They don't make names like that nowadays.
He got up from the table and, opening a kitchen drawer, pulled out two handfuls of cutlery, a dozen knives, forks and spoons, which he dumped with a clatter on the tabletop.
The Black Hall of Calcutta, he said, sitting himself down again. You must have heard of that.
No, I said.
146 Englishmen packed into a cell no bigger than your butler's pantry at Buckshaw. June, hottest month of the year. Next morning, no more than 23 of them left alive.
I tried for a moment to imagine myself opening the door of Dogger's pantry and having 123 dead bodies come tumbling out onto the kitchen floor, leaving another two dozen or so poor human beings cringing, terrified, in the shadowy corners. But I couldn't. It was unthinkable.
Eat something awful, Alf went on. No air, it's murder, plain and simple. What do you do?
Revenge? I asked. It seemed to me the logical answer.
Revenge is right,
Alf said, slamming his fist down onto the tabletop, causing the cutlery to jump.
Here's the Vagarosi River, he said, quickly placing a knife. And here, positioning a salt shaker, is Suraj ud Dawla, the last Nawab of Bengal, the enemy. He's 19 years old and has the temper of a cobra with a festered fang. As an army of 50,000 foot, 18,000 horses, 53 pieces of cannon, and 40 Frenchmen to work 'em.
Alf had suddenly come to life. It was easy to see that he was as passionate about British military history as I was about poisons.
Over here, to the west, is Clive, with the 39th Regiment, Robert Clive. Not even a military man by profession, when you come right down to it. He's a bookkeeper. A bookkeeper. But he's a British bookkeeper. But for all that, he once marched his men to battle through a storm, thundering and lightning to beat blue blazes. Natives thought he was some kind of a war god.
Alf sighed.
Those were the days, those were. Now then, at Plassey, he's got 3,200 men and 9 guns. It's the monsoon season, raining cats and dogs again, outnumbered more than 15 to 1. What do you suppose he did?
He attacked, I said, guessing.
Too bleeding well true he attacked, Alf said, swivelling a sugar spoon and hopping it across the table. Suraj ud Dawla took to his heels on a camel.
He swept the spoons and forks of the Nawab's army off the table and onto the floor.
I'll wash up later, he said. 500 dead. British losses? 22 dead and 15 wounded.
I let out a low whistle.
How could that be? I asked.
Nuob didn't keep his powder dry, Alf said. Can't fight with wet powder.
I nodded wisely.
Very interesting, I said. Whatever became of him?
The Nuob. He was executed about a week later by his successor.
And Clive?
Slit his own throat years later in London.
Ugh,
I said, even though I was interested.
I suppose you're wondering why I'm telling you all this,
Alf said.
Just a little, I admitted.
Because, Alf said, watching carefully to see my reaction, one of them officers of His Majesty's, that'd be George II, mind, 39th Regiment of Foot, was an ancestor of Mrs. Ridley Smith.
I sucked in my breath.
Mrs. Ridley Smith, the magistrate's wife, Jocelyn's mother.
One and the same, Alf said. Funny old world, innit?
But how do you know that? I asked.
Old Beatty told me. He was gardener at Bogmore Hall, man and boy, for 60 years or more. I worked alongside him as a lad, just a nipper I was. But old Beatty enjoyed having someone to rattle off his stories to. A great storyteller was old Beatty. Put a lot of trust in him, the Ridley Smiths. The magistrate brought him out to India to see to his garden. Up country from Calcutta it was. Marvellous flowers, old Beatty used to say. Bleeding marvellous.
Just a minute, I said. I'm confused. Was Magistrate Ridley Smith in India?
When he was a young man, some kind of district magistrate, met his wife out there. Ada, her name was. A family had been in India for donkey's years. British, of course, but they'd been there for generations. Jocelyn was born while they were out there.
And his mother?
She died.
She died when he was born?
So old Beatty told me.
Aha! So that was it. Mrs. Ridley Smith was the sad-eyed woman in the photograph on Jocelyn's wall. Was she ill? I asked. Before Jocelyn was born, I mean.
She was nervy, Alf said. Kept to herself like. Spent all her time with the soldiers.
He was watching me to see my reaction.
Soldiers?
Tin soldiers. Thousands of them.
I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Tin soldiers? A grown woman playing with tin soldiers? She bought them for Jocelyn? I asked.
No. She died when he was born, remember?
Perhaps she was keeping them for when he was older.
Alf smiled.
No. She had them since she was a girl. Handed down from her military ancestors. Each one had added to the collection. It was Robbie-like.
Soldiers, I said. I could scarcely believe it.
Soldiers,
Alf said, bending and picking up, piece by piece, the scattered pieces of cutlery from the floor.
These he replaced in neat rows on the table, naming each as he set it gently into position.
First Division here, he said. First Madras European Regiment. Second Division here. First Madras and Bombay European Regiments. Third Division is Majesty's 39th Regiment of Foot. One of them, and God only knows which one, being her great-great-great or whatever he was, grandfather. Fourth Division, the Bombay European Regiment, and here, 2,000 sepoys, the native foot soldiers, the 1st Bengal Regiment, Royal Artillery. That's us then, he finished, all present and accounted for.
But what about the Nawab? I asked. What about his 50,000 fighters?
Oh, they were there right enough,
Alf said quietly.
Old Beatty said she had a little toy figure for every one of them. Every last blinking one.
He let this sink in. You mean? I asked.
That's right, miss,
he said.
Had a room built special. Kept it locked up tight as a treasury, she did. Nobody allowed in but herself. Old Beatty only knew about it because he was called in one time to carry her out when she'd fainted. That didn't stop him having a good look round, though.
I edged forward on my chair, begging with my eyes for more.
The whole battlefield at Plassey, she had, laid out like a model. Exact scale replica of the real thing. Huge it was. Rocks, hills, park plain of trees. The Vagarathi River was a mirror, tinted blue. Wonderful clever with their hands, the Indians. Filled the whole room, wall to wall to wall to wall. Marvellous to see, albeit, he said.
And Mrs. Ridley Smith?
Locked herself away in there from morning to night, moving the figures round, fighting the Battle of Plassey over and over and over again.
But her husband, I said, the magistrate, the chancellor, did he think she was...
Right in the head? Nobody knows. He never mentions a name.
A chill went through me. I would not think why until later.
The press, they calls it nowadays. Back then it was more likely the vapours or some such like.
What about her family? Were they like that too?
Solid as rocks, a lot of them. Soldiers, lawyers, nabobs in the East India Company back to the year dot. They left her pretty well alone with her toys, at least according to old Beatty.
Thank you, Mr. Mullet, I said, scraping back my chair and giving his hand a shake. I'd better be getting along. I don't want anyone to be worrying about me. The truth was, I needed to talk to Dogger immediately. It was a matter of life and death. As I pedalled past St. Tancred's, my eye was caught by a crowd milling outside the front door of the church. I skidded to a stop. The vicar was standing in the porch, his hands raised.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, he was saying.
I parked Gladys against the wall and crept slowly forward through the crowd, trying not to be noticed. Most of the people were from Bishop's Lacey, but a few of them were not. One of the strangers was a tall, thin man in a grey trench coat and red bow tie, with a notebook in his hand. At his side was another, shorter man, similarly dressed, holding a press camera up to his eyes.
But they're saying it's a miracle, Vicar. Surely you can spare us a few words?
The vicar tried without success to smooth down his disarranged hair, which was blowing in the wind. As he did so, a flashbulb went off.
What did you think when you saw the blood? Another man called out. We were told someone threw away their crutches. Is it true?
A murmur went through the crowd.
Gentlemen, please, all in good time. What about the corpse in the crypt, Vicar?
I could already see the sensational headlines in tomorrow's Hindley Chronicle and the Morning Post Horn, and so, I knew, could the vicar.
The corpse in the crypt. Saint weeps blood.
With that kind of publicity, the bishop would soon have him paddling to a new post somewhere up the Amazon. The press was ruthless, but then so was the church.
Gentlemen, please, we must remember that today is Good Friday. Nothing must be allowed to profane.
Let me through, I shouted. It's an emergency. Please, let me through.
I pushed my way into the crowd and stepped up beside the vicar. Taking his elbow in my hand, I said in a stage whisper, just loud enough to be overheard by the newspaper reporters,
I'm afraid she's taken a turn for the worse, Vicar. The doctor says she may not last. They need you to come at once.
I hopped from foot to foot, squinting horribly, trying to force a tear to my eye. The vicar looked at me as if he had just awakened suddenly on another planet.
Please, I whimpered. Then added in a loud and rising wail, before it's too late.
I pulled at his arm, swung him round, dragged him into the porch, slammed the heavy door shut, and shot the iron bolt.
Phew, I said, what a siege, just like in Ivanhoe. We can sneak out through the vestry.
The vicar looked at me for a moment with empty eyes. He was even more shaken than I had thought. This whole business was taking its toll, to say nothing of his troubles with Cynthia. I walked him to one of the back pews and sat down beside him.
Everything's going to be all right, I told him. I've almost got it figured out.
His face, shaded with mauve from the colored windows above, turned reluctantly toward me.
Oh, Flavia, he said, if only that were true.
Chapter 19. It was not until I was halfway home that the indignation struck me. If only that were true, indeed. It was obvious from his words that in spite of his calling, the vicar was a man of little faith. I had taken him by the hand and led him out through the vestry, tiptoed with him through the churchyard, and delivered him safely to the vicarage door. I had lurked behind a large tombstone and watched as the grumbling crowd slowly broke up and drifted away. Not one of them had even thought of looking round behind the church. Not one had thought to follow us on our sad procession to the imaginary deathbed. They had all been so touched by my pretended mission of mercy that nobody, not even the most hardened of the newspaper men, had tried the church door. And yet the vicar had no faith in me. I hate to admit how much that stung. The best thing for soothing a disappointed mind is oxygen. A couple of deep inhalations of the old O rejuvenates every cell in the body. I suppose I could have gone upstairs to my laboratory for a bit of the bottle stuff, but to me, that would have been cheating. There is nothing like oxygen in its natural form. Oxygen, which has been naturally produced in a forest or a greenhouse, where many plants, by the process of photosynthesis, are absorbing the poisonous carbon dioxide which we breathe out, and giving us oxygen in exchange. I had once remarked to Feely that because of the oxygen, breathing fresh air was like breathing God, but she had slapped my face and told me I was being blasphemous. The greenhouse at Buckshaw, I had found, always cheered me up instantly, although how much of that was due to Dogger's presence and how much to oxygen, I couldn't say. Probably half and half. This much was certain. A greenhouse is a placid place. You never hear about axe murders taking place in a greenhouse. My theory is that it is because of the O. I found Dogger among the flower pots, lashing garden tools into bundles with heavy twine. Dogger, I said casually, stifling a yawn as I bent over to inspect a potted polyanthus. What would you say if I asked you the cause of wasted thumb muscles and drooping hands?
I should say you'd been at Bogmore Hall, Miss Flavia.
I suppose I should have been dumbfounded, but somehow I wasn't. You've seen the photograph of Mrs. Ridley Smith?
No, Dogger replied, but I have overheard the idle chatter of servants.
And?
Most unfortunate. By what I have been able to piece together, a classic case of lead poisoning. The flexor muscles and, to a lesser degree, the extensors are affected. But you will have spotted that already, won't you, miss?
Yes, I said, but I needed you to verify it. There was a silence as each of us considered how to handle what was inevitably coming next.
You've known about it all along.
I ventured not to make my words sound like an accusation.
Yes,
he said, and there was a sadness in his words.
I've known about it all along.
There was another silence, and I realized suddenly that it was because both of us were avoiding any mention of Harriet. She used to visit him, didn't she? I asked. Jocelyn, I mean.
Yes,
Dogger said, simply.
And you went with her?
No, miss. You must remember, I wasn't yet at Buckshaw in those days.
Of course. How stupid of me. What was I thinking of? Dogger hadn't come to Buckshaw until after the war.
He must have heard about the Ridley Smiths, as I did, from someone else.
But he's a prisoner,
How could they keep him locked up like that?
Is he locked up? Dogger began.
Of course he is, I said, perhaps too loudly. Behind a set of double doors.
Or is he being protected?
Now I found myself speaking too quietly. I hadn't thought of that, I admitted.
No, Dogger said. People often don't. One reads these stories in the daily press and jumps to conclusions. Facts are often in direct opposition to assumptions.
To the headlines, I said, thinking for an instant of the vicar.
Yes, Dogger said. As you know from your own studies, lead poisoning is not a pretty thing.
It was true. I had read about what happened to women who had used it in hair dyes or had slathered quack cosmetics containing carbonate of lead onto their faces. Stuff with names like Cosmetique Infallible and Ali Ahmed's Treasures of the Desert. I let my mind fly back to those fat books in Uncle Tar's library in which I had first come across the details. Christison's A Treatise on Poisons, Taylor's Principles and Practice of Medical Jurisprudence, and Bleiss' Poisons, Their Effects and Detection, which, since I had discovered them, had become my Old and New Testaments and my Apocrypha. I thought of the gruesome but fascinating horrors that lay within their pages. The wrist drop, or lead palsy, the paleness, the bloodlessness, the headaches, the foul taste in the mouth, the cramping legs, the difficulty in breathing, the vomiting, the diarrhea, the convulsions, the unconsciousness. I knew that if by some magic we had been able to peel back the lips of Ada Ridley Smith in that old black and white photograph, we should have spotted at least a trace of the blue line where her gums met her teeth. The classic sign of plumbism, better known as lead poisoning. No wonder the woman was depressed.
Lead toy soldiers painted with lead paint, Dogger said. Intended to be looked at, not played with. Not, at least, in such great numbers.
But Jocelyn, I said.
Unfortunately, the damage is already done. Dogger shook his head. He was born poisoned.
It seemed too shocking a thought to be put into mere words.
The brain of an unborn baby is a most susceptible target, Dogger said. Women suffering from lead poisoning more often than not lose the child. But not always, he added. Not always.
Tell me about the not always, I said quietly.
Children born of a lead-poisoned mother seldom survive more than 2 or 3 years. The odds are less than 3 in 100.
But what's to be done? I asked. Surely we can't allow him to be cooped up like that. It isn't right.
Dogger put aside the rakes and hoes. Sometimes, he said, a jackstraw family life is the best that can be hoped for.
He paused and then went on as quietly as if he were dusting furniture.
It may not be ideal, but still, it might be the best possible under the circumstances. The slightest interference might bring the whole thing tumbling down entirely like a house of cards.
Suddenly I didn't want to talk about this anymore. It was odd. Perhaps I was overtired. Father had more than once lectured us about overexertion. But perhaps he was right. I had had rather a hectic day.
I have taken the liberty of preparing a nest for Esmeralda, Dogger said, neatly changing the subject, and laying on a supply of the approved feed.
He pointed to a wooden box in the corner where Esmeralda was nestling in a luxurious bed of straw. I hadn't even noticed her. Dogger, I said, you're a darling.
I don't know what came over me. It just slipped out. I was mortified. It was the sort of thing Feely's friend Sheila Foster might have said. I'm sorry, I told him. I didn't mean... And then I fled, leaving Dogger placidly at work amidst his atmosphere of oxygen. What was happening to my world? Everything was topsy-turvy. Buckshaw was to be sold. Father had told me I was Harriet, and so, more or less, had Jocelyn Ridley-Smith. Taffy had hugged me. The vicar had doubted me. I had learned that I was likely a collateral descendant of a saint. I had already begun to love the hated Cynthia. I had allowed myself to burst into tears in front of Mrs. Mullet. And now I had spoken down to Dogger as if I were a cinema star and he a mere hireling. The universe was changing in ways that I did not necessarily approve of. If only we could go back to the good old days of a week ago, when, as unpleasant as they might have seemed, we were revolving securely in our dusty old orbits. Feely, it seemed, was, as Sherlock Holmes once called Dr. Watson, the one fixed point in a changing world. Throughout the events of the past few days, Feely had somehow managed to remain her same unpleasant self. Could it be that goodness waxes and wanes like the moon, and that only evil is constant? If I could find the answer to that question, perhaps everything else would come clear. It was, in a way, the same problem that was now facing Inspector Hewitt and me, and to a lesser degree, I suppose, Adam Sowerby and Miss Tanti. Could it be that some person with an otherwise spot